Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Gavin Freegard, speaking today about data is plural, and I can see some of you bristling at that already, which is a good start. For any of you who've been interested in government data over the last few years, you may have had the misfortune to encounter me already, and you may remember me from such things as the National Data Strategy Sea Shanty, the data game, the world's first, the world's best, the world's only data game show, and more charts than you can shake a spreadsheet package at, including one about ministerial resignations that even made it onto Have I Got News For You? Genuine reaction to a graph on a comedy show there. I do actually do some serious stuff too. I'm a freelancer who spent a lot of time thinking about how government uses data and data policy, including at the Institute for Government, where I was full-time for many years, connected by data, and the Open Data Institute. And of course, like many data policy people, I'm now also an AI policy person. Same thing, just a snazzier jacket. Now, in all of that time, there have been lots of really big controversies around data and AI. Everything on from the UK losing its early lead on open data and open government, to dodgy statistics. The A-level algorithm fiasco. I'm not the Gav they're referring to there on the placard, at least I hope not. The botched attempt to make more use of people's personal health data, which actually caused the number of people opting out of their data being used to double. And most recently, I've been working with civil society colleagues to stop the dangerous, disastrous dog's dinner of a data protection and digital information bill. Controversy crammed into every clause, safeguards swept away, rights ridden over roughshod, imperiling the Information Commission's independence, social security surveillance, political party micro-targeting, and many other terrible things as well, which we have now successfully stopped for now. Thank you. I'm not going to take all the credit. But by some distance, forget all of those things. Forget the balance between privacy and openness. Forget whether AI will be harmful or helpful in public services. The most controversial debate I've ever encountered has been this. Do we talk about the data is or the data are? Now, even when I was discussing the title of this talk with my Connected by Data colleagues on Discord, appropriately enough, a colleague said I should call this talk Data Are Plural, not Data Is Plural. A few years ago, I said something approving on Twitter, remember Twitter, about how one organisation had approached this particular question. Now, polling companies, when they're conducting polls, sometimes have space for an extra question. And someone I knew from a polling company DM'd me to say that they told some of their colleagues that they should actually poll this question. So one thing led to another, and YouGov actually polled this. Now, just to prove that, I've blocked out the numbers to build up some suspense. Are you feeling some suspense about the answer? But you can see this is a genuine poll from YouGov. Do you want to see the results?
Yes.
Well, 12% of people said they didn't know, fence sitters, while 74% of people said singular, the data is, and 14% of people were totally wrong. Now, out of interest, hands up, who in here thinks it is singular, the data is? Excellent. How many data are people have we got? I'm so sorry. But nobody's perfect. I'm going to show you one final chart. We can also see the results of that question by age. That's the overall one. And now we can see it by age group as well. So those of us who think it's the data is are younger and better looking as well. That's how statistics work. I don't make the rules. Of course, I get the grammatical arguments in favour of the data are. There were many of them in response to YouGov's tweet and my tweet about that particular poll. And in supporting the other side, I could appeal to a higher power, but I would argue that it simply feels antiquated, like capitalizing nouns randomly in the middle of sentences, or using what looks like an F instead of a modern S. Now, obviously, I didn't come all the way here for a discussion about grammar. Sorry if that's what you were expecting. Or to spend ages defining plural, which I'll take to mean more than one of something or containing several diverse elements. Instead, I came to use the data is, data are debate to tenuously tie together some important points around the conceit that for all that data is singular grammatically, it's plural in important ways, actually. The first point is probably an obvious one in which data is actually plural, and it's that data covers many different things. And sometimes it can be difficult to get hold of this subject because data is, in a sense, everything. Now, this is a sort of diagram we did as part of an Institute for Government and NESTA project a few years ago to think about the different ways of thinking about data. Now, if we're thinking about data in government, we might be talking about everything from statistics and analysis that inform policy, operational and administrative data, much of that personal and sensitive, that helps run public services, the open data that we can publish for businesses and society to reuse, or knowledge and information management inside government, or of course, all of the data that underpins all of the technical systems that make all of those things work. Lots of different things that we might be talking about. Those different domains have different contexts, will require different approaches, even if there is stuff that we can learn and apply across them. And that's before we even get to the subject of the data we're talking about. Are we talking about my weight or step count, the number of hospital beds, specific health outcomes, how happy that makes us, what that does to our voting intention? So we actually have to consider the plurality of what data might be in order to get specific about what data we're actually talking about. That might seem obvious, but I think there are actually two particular dangers when we don't do that and we just talk in general terms about the data. The first is that talking about data in the abstract, we actually make it more real in a very specific and dangerous way, and that's giving data, and increasingly AI, agency. Data-driven alliterates a lot better than data-informed, but it gives it, data, objectivity and agency that is misleading. The singularity we should be worried about is less HAL from 2001 A Space Odyssey attaining superintelligence than language giving these machines an identity that obscures the very human decisions that shape them, what they do, and how they're used. In fact, we should move away from the sci-fi scaremongering and humanoid blue robots to demystify what AI actually is. A great example here from Better Images of AI. The second risk in talking about data in the abstract and talking about it in the singular is that it just becomes an abstract exercise. Better data becomes motherhood and apple pie. Who could possibly disagree with better data? Now, this is from The Atlantic during the COVID pandemic, and they noticed that the US government was actually using the data they were compiling on COVID rather than being able to rely on their own government systems. And they say many stress the importance of data-driven decision-making, yet all of the US government's plans largely assumed that detailed and reliable data would simply exist. They were less concerned with how those data would actually be made. So they were talking in generalities about the importance of better data, but nobody actually thought about the pipelines that would take the data that needed to get to decision makers from where it was to where it needed to be. Now, we had something similar in the UK. I've written a long read on the R number, remember that, for understanding patient data, which is currently being serialised by the Royal Statistical Society, and actually looking at the UK experience, there's some incredible ingenuity and industry from a lot of civil servants and scientists to make all of this work. But at the start, we were in a very similar place. Our data systems were people in number 10 calling up hospitals, then being bombarded with emails, individual emails for individual patients from individual hospitals with individual deaths, PowerPoint, Excel, Word. There was no real system to speak of. And in fact, if you look at our planning beforehand, again, lots of talk about the importance of better data. Our main tabletop government planning exercise for a pandemic picked up the pandemic in week 7. It didn't look at how we would actually get the data we needed before that. Now, as I said, there is also a brilliant story about that ingenuity in what then happened. These are all of the different modeling groups that were involved in modeling the R number. And you can see on the left-hand side, all of the different types of data data that they were using. Now think about getting specific with all of those different things. Think about building the infrastructure needed to support about all of those things. Think about all of the decisions that are being made and shape how all of those different, very different data sets are being collected and being used. Those small decisions can have a really big impact. So we need to get specific, which we can only do by thinking about data in the plural. Another issue is thinking about the same data and the plurality of contexts in which it might be used. Now, there's often a lot of frustration in government that data sharing isn't easier, because actually being able to do that would allow us to plan better policy, make better operational decisions, run better public services, and sometimes it's legally not possible. But sometimes there are good reasons why there's a friction there. Now let's take one example. So this is the National Pupil Database at the Department for Education, often used by schools to help improve people's education. Good thing. We can then use that same data for respected research institutions, in this case the Institute for Fiscal Studies, to use that same data to do some research, understand what better policy might look like. Again, good. I think a lot of people would agree, as long as it's done securely and safely. DfE was sharing pupil nationality data with the Home Office and Immigration. Maybe not quite so good. A lot more controversy around that particular use. And very recently, thanks to work from Defend Digital Me, a very good pressure group and campaign, recently it's turned out that that same National Pupil Database data has been used by DWP to look at sort of fraud and benefits fraud. How do we feel about that? We probably feel quite different about those very different scenarios, even though it's using the same data. It fundamentally changes your relationship as a child, a parent, or a citizen with the Department for Education if that data is being used by other departments for different purposes. This is a bit of old polling from 2014, but I'm just going to highlight the ones relating to health. You can see something similar happening here. If you look at the blue bars are showing things that people should happen, and they think, for instance, right at the top, very popular, that all hospitals and GPs should be able to access health records directly relating to your care. Much smaller blue bar when it comes to health records being sold to private healthcare companies to make money for government. So actually how we feel about that use of data depends very much on who is doing the use and what purpose they're using it for. Next thing to think about with data as plural is sort of having to set data in a much broader plurality of contexts. Sometimes when we get data, it's only one data point, one data set, one view of the world, and we always have to remember that to actually give it its full value. Some of you may have seen this. To derive true value, we need to move up the knowledge pyramid. We should see that data right down at the bottom, just as the way to then add more context, bring greater understanding, bring in together lots more information that helps us set that data properly in context. We should be using the data as a way to bring the right people together to ask the right questions about the right subject, not the answer purely in and of itself. We often don't do that for various time reasons, various culture reasons, sometimes over-reliance on numerical data, quantitative data, particularly as a silver bullet. Now, there's been a fashion recently for dashboards. The one you can see on the screen is the COVID-19 dashboard, and that actually is a very good example of how to do a dashboard. Lots of transparency about where the data was coming from, lots of investment in the data pipelines, a lot of sort of long-term thinking, not just the short-term. But dashboards do have their drawbacks. They can privilege certain types of information, particularly that quantitative, numerical data. They can hide all of the challenges in bringing that data together. And of course, in striving for the clarity that you can present using a dashboard can strip the data of all context. This recent excellent piece by C.T. Nguyen, as a professor, goes much further and says actually the very act of using data is to strip it of the context from which it comes. Actually, to make data useful, it has a sort of universality. You can distill things down very easily in a way that is portable, can be picked up by lots of different people in different institutions. But of course, you're stripping all of the contextual information away from it when you're doing that. So actually, the very use of data is in many ways limiting it. We can sometimes forget that the categories are social inventions created for a purpose. This data can be extremely useful, but we have to remember its limitations, and so often we don't. They use the example of sort of using different categories in reporting on ethnicity, for instance. We can lump together various different groups with very different experiences for the sake of forms and spreadsheets. Sometimes things are easier to measure than others. They use the example of people trying to build an AI which would develop good art. Of course, the thing that you can measure with good art is how many people watch it on Netflix. There are lots of things you can't measure so easily, such as the impact it has on us. So there's a privileging there of particular types of data as well. And to be honest, all of it boils down to data is powerful because it's universal, but the cost is context. The R number, our old friend, gives us another sort of example of this. Again, the R number was very useful for giving people something that they could hold on to and conveying a lot of complex information really simply, but it really stripped out a lot of important context. If you look at the bottom one, which I'm stood right in front of, which is a bit inconvenient for you, this was evidence that I gave to the COVID inquiry, and it's a letter to the British Medical Journal from fairly early on in the pandemic, where doctors were realising that actually people from ethnic minority backgrounds would be being disenfranchised in three different ways. First of all, their groups were much more likely to be in more difficult socioeconomic situations. They were being exposed to a disease which actually had characteristics that were attacking their communities more strongly than others. But also, the R number and other policy measures were based on other groups. They weren't taking into account that ethnic diversity, so they were suffering in different ways. It's a really good reminder of the context and the diversity and plurality that we need to bring to those sorts of decisions. The final point I sort of make is that our individual data actually has its value in the plural, and that is how we should start thinking about it. We often think about data about us in very individual ways. GDPR is set up around individual rights. Solutions to misuse and abuse of our data, it's often to give us more personal individual control, personal data stores, things like that. Those would undoubtedly help, a lot of those measures, but it's not enough. And here are two important examples. One is that consent is a little bit broken. This was a recent news story where somebody had hidden an offer of free wine for anyone who spotted the mention of free wine in the terms and conditions on a particular website. It took 3 months for anyone to actually read that and claim it. We often say yes to things in order to access services without really getting to the heart of it. And the second is that how data actually works now is that decisions are being made about us using lots of other people's data. This is an example of a guy called Kevin Johnson, who was on his honeymoon and realized that American Express were changing his credit rating and overdraft and credit limit. And the reason they did that was because other customers who've used their card where you recently shopped have a poor repayment history with American Express. So it was nothing that he had done. It was based on data from other people. It's actually from 2008, so it's not a new problem. More recently, this paper from Salomé Villion, for instance, says that we need to think about data governance in a relational way. Lots of organizations, governments, big tech, they use individual data about us not to make individual decisions about us, but in aggregate to make decisions about lots of people. So we are truly connected by data. It means that we need those sort of more collective mechanisms to think about how all this happens as well. Also because not always a lot of our personal data being used. Think, for instance, what if a sat-nav service starts sending loads of traffic down your street? Your personal data isn't involved there at all, and yet it's having quite a profound impact on your life. So how can we tackle this? Well, we've got an election at the moment, so maybe we'll start talking about some of these issues. But broadly speaking, I think we need a much more plural approach. It needs to be a very political and human one. Just looking at some of the things that we were arguing about when it came to the Data Protection Bill, for instance, things like making sure that provisions think about decision subjects, those who are subject to decisions, not just data subjects, people whose data has gone in, thinking about risk assessments in a way that thinks about group and societal risks, requiring consultation. We really need to think about participation and engagement in these discussions, providing collective mechanisms, so class actions, not just individual ones, and transparency would also help when it's enforced by all of those things. I'm going to skip through a few slides. And just come to a very quick summary, which is that when it comes to the grammar, I'm afraid I am going to stick with the singular. The data is clear. But when it comes to how we think about collect, use, and govern data, we need to embrace the plural. It's in thinking about the plurality of what data we're talking about that allows us to be more grounded and specific in how to ethically approach it. It's in thinking about the plural contexts around data and its many limitations that we can get most value from it. It's in thinking about how data about us relates to the plurality of others that we engage with how the world really works. And it's in plurality and democracy where choices about all of those challenges should reside. That much, I hope, are clear. Thank you.